I think, ladies and gentlemen, you all know that there is a religious rule that no Middle East meeting should begin on time and that we should wait another 15 minutes. But since we have, I think, a sufficiently large audience, let's break the precedent and go ahead. I am really just the excuse to have Craig Charney give a very detailed presentation of what polling can tell us about the causes and attitudes, really the shape of instability in the region. But I did want to begin by making some points which really I think have been made for a very long time. I have heard people say that all of this came as a surprise. How could one incident in Morocco trigger a process that reached across the region? Why did it gather so much momentum so soon? And what's interesting is if you look back at the problem was it was so much worse in distribution than in other areas. So again, the measures of economic growth and GDP growth and other measures would basically have been misleading and concealed the countries where you had growing disparities and growing problems. One thing was very clear, that per capita incomes, when you looked at the states which were not wealthy oil states, that small populations and high oil revenues, had very low per capita incomes. And this is a great problem with regional statistics. They disguise at every level just how bad the problems were in many of the countries involved. And this is, I think, obviously economics are only one factor, but they were fairly critical. One thing that I would just point out, and I think, again, most of you are aware of this, the whole term oil wealthy state is a statistical fiction. A few states, mainly Qatar and a few Gulf states, are oil wealthy in per capita income terms. In many cases, you have just the opposite. Not only do you have a low oil revenue per capita, but oil distorts the economy and it actually acts as a way of inhibiting growth and diversification. So what's sometimes called the oil disease is just as real in the Middle East and North Africa as it is elsewhere. Price pressures. One thing that you have in the Middle East that is fairly unique by most surveys is a very high ratio of food expenditure relative to total income. There's never been a totally consistent pattern, but that spike you see in the far margin there is the most recent trend in oil prices. And it followed on another rise that occurred before the cycle of unrest. So you had very tangible pressures. With housing, you don't see the rise in prices, you just see a shortfall in housing units. And the only thing worse than high rentals and high prices is no home. And that was a broadly distributed issue. Looking at performance by rule of law, and all of these, of course, are judgmental, you had what in many surveys from many different sources was emerging as very widespread public discontent. Within this, there is a whole range of surveys done by country. And we normally think of corruption as being something that either happens day to day or at the top. What is striking is how many people felt the justice system was fundamentally corrupt. And they were in general right. Many of the countries which were actually looking at this were finding that they had serious problems with their courts. Another factor that grew up, and I don't have growth data that are accurate, but they're critical here, was the steady growth of paramilitary and internal security forces. Now, you can find many human rights reports that make complaints all over the world. What was striking in this area was how quickly and how often the state was actually increasing its police, its internal security, and its other forces, and they were not passive for obvious reasons. Some countries had a problem in terms of foreign labor, but I think that's minor compared to the other problems that were occurring. If you look at just this sample of the Middle East, the black lines are Egypt. And you tend to think of Egypt as being a country driven by population problems, and it is. But Egypt's base in 1950 was 21 million, and the estimate for 2050 is 137 million. That is a major increase, but if you look at the increase for Syria, that same increase is 10 times over the period. And I can remember driving through Iraq back in the early 70s at a time where the population was arguably around 9 million. You're now talking 30 million and counting, and you are headed fairly rapidly toward 42 million. These are desert areas, and there is only so much you can do. You also see, and I think all of you are aware of this, of the problem of the youth bulge, the very high numbers of people. Sometimes you have entry levels into the labor force which are equal to 4% of the labor force in a single year. That puts incredible job pressure on the region, and it produced all kinds of distortions. It is a particular problem because there is, throughout the area, even when women are employed, the productivity gain given to women's jobs is often very limited. So you often were creating jobs that did not have a positive economic output, and that was a matter of state policy. And if you look at it compared to other regions, you look at total unemployment, which is this line, and you look at the percentage in is that line, and this is youth unemployment, and look at the yellow spot in the far upper corner there. I think these are pressures which, again, vary sharply by country. There's no standard model here, but they're sharp enough to be critical. Population below the poverty line. The real problem here is we needed to redefine the poverty line 15 years ago. People who are above the poverty line basically have absolutely no reason in most countries to have any faith in the government because they have no status. They simply survive. And one of our problems here is we also do not have any meaningful measures of just how bad income distribution is within the region or by country in a reliable form. There are estimates. They do show that income distribution was getting substantially worse. You were pushing people out of the middle class, out of professional status and income. A very narrow group was getting high profit margins, but you do not have consistent or reliable data. Female labor participation rates, again, these figures are much more positive than they should be because many of these are make-work jobs where women really do not have a productive output but are simply given a job or a role in the society. If you look at internet users, well, all right, but I think just to conclude, these figures are fairly dismal in terms of the disparity as to what given countries are spending as a percentage on education. I tried to make them work in terms of trends for actual per capita expenditure on education. I couldn't find any really comparable sources, but with the exception of the Gulf countries, per capita expenditure on education has been going down very sharply, and costs do not rise simply in the United States on education. You have a similar pattern in terms of health care. And I think all of these factors taken together sort of lay the groundwork to Craig's presentation, because behind all of the politics, all of the ideology, all of the religious issues are some tremendous forces affecting the entire region. And they have built up over decades, and they are the source of many of the pressures we have seen explode since the events in Morocco. The one caution I would give you, or Tunisia, I'm sorry, the one caution I would give you is these pressures are not subject to regime. Even if you had a perfect government tomorrow in many of the states, they would take a decade to turn around in ways which would produce broad change that could meet everyone's expectations. The chances of perfect governments are fairly limited. And until you have much better governments, what you see in the latest reporting of the IMF and elsewhere is every country that has had significant political unrest has, in the last 9 months, seen a sharp deterioration in most of the conditions I have shown you here. In other words, there is an almost direct correlation between the Arab Spring and making the conditions of life worse in every state where it has taken place. Craig, let me turn that over to you.
Tony has given you the facts. Now I'm going to give you some opinions. Because what began in Tunisia and Egypt a year ago startled the world, but as Tony correctly said, it shouldn't have. This presentation was put together to help understand the roots and implications of the current upheaval in the Arab world. And my goal is to provide an overview of public opinion to help explain the outbreak and course of revolution and protest in 2011, drawing on polls from the last 5 years. By the way, I am, for those who want a copy of the presentation and so you needn't frantically scribble down numbers, I'm circulating a sign-up sheet, so anyone who wants to receive a copy will do so. Next slide, please. Oops. Now, the data used in this presentation were gathered from over 40 scientific polls conducted across the region as recently as this fall. They were conducted by trained local interviewers in Arabic among cross-sections of national populations by professional polling organizations. 9 were done by my firm, Charney Research, in 6 different countries from 2008 to 2011, and the others were conducted in a total of 15 countries by leading U.S. polling groups, including Gallup, Pew, and Greenberg. So with that out of the way, I'm going to explore the economic and political factors, economic despair and political repression, that help explain why certain countries in the region have experienced upheaval or protest while others have not. Then the key common factors which have emerged in Arab political thinking, including support for democracy, peaceful change, and open economies that have helped to impel the changes we've witnessed. We'll look at access to new media like the internet, mobile phones, and above all TV, which have also been factors in the Arab Spring, as well as the impact of the revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia on their societies and on their political systems, as well as the reasons for Islamist success in those countries. Then finally, we'll look at attitudes on foreign affairs, including attitudes towards the UN, US, and Iran. So, to begin with, next slide, please. In the Arab world, the countries where the fewest people were thriving were the likeliest to experience popular revolt. Now, we divided the Arab countries into 3 groups based on events in the past year. In the first group, the countries that experienced the greatest upheaval had the smallest proportions who were reported to be thriving in all our surveys, an average of 10%. We call this group Group 1, and you'll recognize all of these names. The countries in the middle group, ranked in terms of the proportion who were thriving, experienced somewhat less upheaval, but still a substantial amount of instability. And the average proportion thriving here was 18%. We call that Group 2. Group 3 on the right contains the most stable countries, who are all Gulf oil producers, and an average of 50% in these countries consider themselves to be thriving. Now, the combination of political oppression and despair has produced upheaval in these countries. Although the most developed countries, Group 3, are the most stable, instability is not just a matter of absolute poverty. Bahrain, Tunisia, and Libya, countries where regimes have been shaken or overthrown, all have relatively high per capita incomes. This underlines, as Tony pointed out, that the issue here is distribution as much as absolute poverty. This is a revolution of relative deprivation. the wretched of the earth are not on Facebook. So what else do countries where regions where the regimes were shaken have in common? Next slide, please. Well, another factor common among the countries in Group 1, where regimes fell or almost fell, is that they experienced a sharp drop in well-being in the last 3 years. In each of these countries, the proportion thriving fell considerably between 2009, or in the case of Egypt and Tunisia, where we have slightly longer data series, 2007, and 2010 and 2011. This, of course, reflects in part the spike in food prices in 2009 and 2010 that Tony alluded to as well. On the right, we see that Group 1 is unique in this respect. They had an average fall in well-being from 25% to 8%. On the other hand, in the other two groups, well-being did not change significantly. In other words, the countries that were in upheaval not only were the ones which were lowest in terms of the absolute ratings for people, the proportion who were thriving, they had also experienced substantial drops in well-being in the 2 years immediately prior to the revolts. Those, then, are key triggering factors. But what are the other economic and political factors linked to the unrest? Now, in the next few slides, you'll see the averages for each of the three groups, Group 1 being the most unstable, Group 2 being the ones which had some unrest, Group 3 being the stable Gulf monarchies. As you can see, discontent over unemployment was highest in the less stable countries. In Group 1 countries, only about one-third were satisfied with job creation. Roughly the same is true in Group 2. In Group 3, on the other hand, things are dramatically different. Two-thirds say that they were satisfied with the level of employment in their countries. So as the self-immolation of jobless protesters underlined, despair at unemployment was linked to unrest. Next slide. Likewise, the countries where people were most unhappy with the local economy were also the least stable. On average, only one-fourth of those living in Group 1 countries thought the local economy where they lived was improving. That was true for almost half of those in Group 2, which were more stable, and three-fourths of those in the Gulf. In other words, the degree of discontent with the economy was directly proportional to the degree of upheaval that countries experienced in 2010 and 2011. Next slide, please. Now, although inequality is also a factor, the countries with more poverty experience more unrest as well. People in the most unstable countries were less able to afford food. An average of 3 in 10 said they could not do so. That was true for 2 in 10 in the Group 2 countries and only 1 in 8 in the Group 3 countries. So higher levels of poverty meant that publics were less likely to be thriving and countries more likely to be unstable. But was the discontent purely economic? Next slide, please. No, politics played a part too. In particular, countries where people felt unable to make themselves heard by government were the most unstable. When asked whether or not they had voiced their opinion to a public official recently, only an average of 1 in 8 in the Group 1 countries had recently done so. And the smallest proportion was in Egypt, where only 4% said that they had dared to speak up. In contrast, 20% in the Group 2 countries and 21% in the Group 3 countries said that they had been willing to voice their opinions. So, in other words, the countries where the public felt least able to express themselves through official channels were the most likely to explode in massive protest. What else was involved? Well, the countries with a majority did not trust domestic media also were less stable. Under half of those in Group 1 and only about a third of those in Group 2 countries had confidence in their local media. The figures ran as low as 1 in 5 in Algeria. This compared with an average of two-thirds in the Group 3 countries. In short, the people who felt their national media was lying to them as part of a system of state control were more likely to revolt. How about the impact of election fraud? When people did not consider elections free and fair, their countries tended to be less stable. In 2010, on average, under half in Group 1 and only about a third of those who lived in Group 2 countries had confidence in previous election results. This included only 28% in Egypt and 25% in Lebanon, both countries with traditions of rigged elections. On the other hand, 3 in 5 had confidence in election results in Group 3 countries. Now, democratic institutions have limited power in these countries as well as restricted franchises. But nonetheless, their publics see the elections that do take place as fair. On the whole, then, in countries where electoral outlets for discontent are closed or phony, it tends to erupt in the streets instead. Now, we've heard a lot about corruption in the Arab world. What difference did corruption make? Well, corruption was seen as much more widespread and bribery more common in both groups, which were less stable. An average of 3 people in 5 in both Group 1 and Group 2 countries said corruption was widespread in their countries. The highest proportions citing such corruption were 77% in Yemen and 68% in Egypt and off the charts, 92% in Lebanon. Nearly half of those in both Groups 1 and 2 also reported that they themselves had actually had to pay a bribe to an official to get service during the previous year. And that compares to only 1 in 5 in Group 3. Now, that doesn't suggest that these countries are free of other forms of corruption, but it does suggest that the kind of everyday, petty official corruption, which is deeply felt and keenly resented in people's lives, was much more a feature of the countries that exploded in protest. So corruption, perceived and experienced, is in fact a notable feature of such countries. Next slide, please. Another common factor corresponding to corruption in the countries which were most unstable was public mistrust of the legal system. Just half in the Group 1 and Group 2 countries had confidence in their judicial system, compared with 4 in 5 in Group 3. And these numbers probably exaggerate the confidence somewhat, because there were evident outliers in the case of Tunisia and Egypt, where 4 in 5 said they had confidence in the rule of law. Now, in Egypt, the courts have a reputation for independence, so that number is probably real. But in Tunisia, they did not under the Ben Ali dictatorship, where social conformity pressures probably dictated the result. In the rest of Group 1, large majorities indicated that they did not believe their countries enjoyed the rule of law. And in the countries where fewer felt protected by law against official abuses, they were more likely to confront them through mass action. Thus, in a sense, the Arab Spring was overdetermined. That is to say, both economic failure and repressive politics both marked the countries where unrest was strongest. Those were the distinctive factors if we look in retrospect. Now, though, if we were to ask what distinguished the countries where regimes collapsed or were shaken, but rather what were the common factors impelling political change all across the region, there are a number of other points which stand out. Above all, the desire for democracy is strong across all the countries surveyed. Averages for those preferring a democratic government were roughly 4 in 5 in all 3 groups of countries. Even, in fact, in Saudi Arabia, an absolute monarchy, more than 7 in 10 would prefer democracy. In fact, in the same study, Saudi Arabia was the only one of the 8 Muslim countries polled where the need for democracy was spontaneously volunteered as one of the country's top 2 problems. So the vast majority in the Arab region wants a more democratic system of government. How then do they view the relationship of democracy to Islam? Well, most Arabs think democracy is compatible with Islam. An average of 2/3 or more throughout the region say the two can go together. Most think that their religion and a democratic government can coexist, and reject the notion that sovereignty belongs to God rather than the people. But did they think democracy could come about peacefully? Well, people in most Arab countries believed in 2010, before the revolutions broke out, that peaceful change alone was preferable to violence. Majorities in all 3 groups preferred peaceful change, 55% in Group 1, 54% in Group 3, 60% in Group 2. Interestingly enough, of all 15 countries in the poll, there was only 1 exception, and that was Libya, where only 1/3 thought peaceful means were the only possible route to change. Libyans appear to have understood that Muammar Gaddafi's regime could only be dislodged by force. Still, the romantic era of Arab revolutionaries forcibly imposing one-party states appears to be well past by now. Arabs prefer peaceful change in general. But what do they think about economic matters? Well, majorities throughout the region also favored foreign trade and globalization. question was posed by Pew and in some of our surveys too. No fewer than 2/3 in each group think foreign trade is good, with between 7 and 9 in 10 saying so in most countries. All the countries surveyed are massively in favor of increasing participation in the international market. Autarky is out in the Arab world. So a new regional political and economic consensus favoring democracy and open economies underlay the current transitions. Now then, what has been the role of the internet, much discussed, in bringing it about? Well, internet access is actually lowest in the most unstable countries and highest in the most stable. Under 3 in 10 Egyptians in the rebellious group 1 countries and only about 1 in 3 in the group 2 countries had access in 2010. Access was very broad in the much richer group 3 countries, on the other hand, about 4 in 5. Now, what this means is that in the less stable countries, on the other hand, access was restricted principally to the young and the better educated. So in those countries, a critical mass of young and discontented people was able to attain access to a medium capable of connecting them to each other and to the outside world while escaping the control of the state. In other words, the internet was important as the medium for activists and the political elites, not for the masses. How about another new medium, the mobile phone? Large majorities across the region have mobile phones, the biggest change in communications technology in the decade, if not, in fact, in its history. 85% or more across the region have mobile phones, and that's a change from between 7 and 23% just a decade earlier. The universality of mobile phones made them a key communications medium in the Arab Spring, together with the internet. By voice and text, people could move, news could rapidly spread, as could protest plans. And the ability to take pictures and video, providing digital material for uploading, it also gave them the immediate capacity to generate news and information through the phone. So the humble phone, more than the web, helped to make the revolutions. What role did TV play? Across the region, television is the primary source for news, but online and print media are more developed in certain countries. Very large majorities in all the countries surveyed watch television for their international news, the green parts of these bars. Internet and print are also important in Jordan, where they're the blue part, in Lebanon, and in the UAE. Sorry, the light blue part, and to a certain extent in Saudi Arabia. So despite the gradually increasing popularity of online media and the limited audience given to print, Arabs still watch TV primarily for their news. Which station? Well, no prizes for guessing. Al Jazeera has the largest news audience shared widely across the region. But MBC, Al Arabiya, and domestic Egyptian networks also are widely viewed. In all 6 countries in this 2010 poll, Al Jazeera has the largest or second largest audience share, the green parts of the bars. Al Arabiya also has a large share in Saudi Arabia and some in the UAE, Lebanon, and even Jordan. That's the blue part. Egyptian TV stations have the majority of viewers in Egypt and also a certain following in Morocco and the UAE. But while Al Jazeera is the overall regional media leader, which helps explain its central role in the uprisings last year, there are also some local favorites as well. So much for the actual sources of the revolution. What's happened since the change of regimes in Tunisia and Egypt? Now, following those countries' largely peaceful revolutions, the national mood in both countries was extremely hopeful. On the left, we see that 4 in 5 in Egypt and Tunisia, a couple of months after their revolutions, both thought the countries were headed in the right direction. And that's a massive turnaround for Egypt, where only 1 in 4 had thought so 3 years earlier. The optimism since has faded to under 50% in Egypt, but it still remains considerably above pre-revolutionary levels. On the right, we see that 3 in 5 Egyptians and 4 in 5 Tunisians also felt that they had hope for the future, another important change from the mood of despair noted in the statistics I presented at the beginning. So the revolutions in both countries produced a tremendous sense of optimism about the future. What then were the people worried about? Well, Following both revolutions, Egyptians and Tunisians saw similar problems facing their countries, namely the economy and security. In Egypt, which we see on the left, one-third saw the economy as the country's biggest problem, followed by one in five who thought the demonstrations, riots, and crime were. Let fewer than one in ten mention government corruption, women's rights, or the formation of a new government. And the pattern is fairly similar in Tunisia. Two in five called the economy the main problem, almost as many internal security, under 10% cited corruption or political reform. Before the 2008 revolution, our 2008 polling found Egyptians' chief concerns to be the economy, corruption, and governance. But after the revolution, both Egyptians and Tunisians were mostly concerned about the economy and security. Their views of governance had actually improved. Next slide. Now, focusing in on this year's elections, voter turnout in Egypt was high as Egyptians went to the polls freely for the first time, while many Tunisians, no longer coerced to vote, sat this election out. In Egypt, three in five voted, and that was vastly more than the 21% who had voted 6 years earlier. The story in Tunisia is a bit more complicated. 89% did so in 2009, just 52% this year. Last year. But although the elections under Ben Ali were not free and fair, the Tunisian public voted because they were essentially compelled to do so, which was not the case in 2011. So in the post-revolutionary period, turnout patterns in Tunisia and Egypt have reflected post-revolutionary conditions of newly free elections. Another similarity that we found between the two states was that after the revolutions, many Egyptians and Tunisians were unfamiliar with the political parties competing for their votes. Now, the bars here represent the proportion who are unfamiliar with various leading political parties, on the left in Egypt. As we can see, the best-known party was the Freedom and Justice Party, the eventual winner, the one which was known by about 60% of the public. But even this party was unknown to two in five, as was the historic Waft Party. Substantial majorities did not know three other parties represented in parliament, about three-fifths, and about four-fifths, we don't have them on this chart, had never heard of the new parties that were competing in this year's election. Likewise, in Tunisia, the best-known party was once again the Islamic Party related to the Muslim Brotherhood, Ennahda, but 30% said that they had never heard of this 3 months after the revolution. And the proportions unfamiliar with the largest opposition party under the old regime or one of the other major opposition parties were roughly 9 in 10. Three-fifths, in fact, of Tunisians professed not to know any. There was a substantial disconnect between the public and political parties, both new and old, of every stripe, although it is worth noting that the Islamist parties enjoyed a crucial advantage in name recognition as they began the electoral process. Now, here we see the results of the two elections. In the case of Egypt, we have only the accumulated results of the first two rounds. Today, we got the results of the third, and they only change this very slightly. In each case, we find that the Islamist party related to the Brotherhood won an almost identical vote share, 37% in each. The big difference is that in Egypt, the Salafis took 27% of the vote. In both countries, about a quarter of the vote went to secular parties. In Tunisia, about one-third went to minor parties and lists that were not represented. Thus, overall, we see major Islamist victories in both countries, and in particular, an even more Islamist-leaning electorate in Egypt. What are some of the reasons for this? Well, first, if we were to speak about what actually happened during the campaigns, what we see is that undecideds moved decisively in the direction of the two Islamic parties. Here we see data from Egypt for the two major parties, the Brotherhood and the Salafis. Now, in the case of the Brotherhood, we see that as late as September, only about 2 months before less than 2 months before the first round, 30% still had no opinion of the Brotherhood. But this group drops sharply to only 9% by December. Likewise, the proportion opposed goes down, but less sharply, from 56 to 42%. Over this time, the proportion of supporters jumps very sharply, from 16 to about 50%. What this means, in other words, is that this group is gaining partly from the conversion of former opponents, but above all, from the mobilization of don't-knows. We see a roughly similar pattern with the Salafis,
where the don't-knows drop sharply as their support goes up sharply, although in this case they do not succeed in converting many of the large number who are hostile to this polarizing party. In other words, the Islamists in Egypt waged a much more effective campaign than their opponents. They won over the don't-know groups. This reflects the presence of their national organizations, unlike those of their opponents in the secular parties. It reflects effective and well-thought-out campaign themes, and it reflects a campaign rhetoric, also, that touched more popular roots. Next slide, please. It also reflects a set of political ideas that had a great deal of appeal. When Shibli Tilhami of Brookings asked people late in the year in Egypt which political system appealed to them the most, the answer quite clearly was the mild Islamist system of Turkey, headed by that country's Justice and Development Party. It was twice as popular as a model based on Western Europe, far more popular than that of the US. On the other hand, hardline Islamist models, the Wahhabist model of Saudi Arabia or the Shiite theocracy of Iran, were attractive to fewer than one Egyptian in 10. In other words, the kind of Egypt they see themselves as voting for does not look like Iran or Saudi Arabia. It's one that looks like Turkey, a westernized, capitalist, and pluralist, a democratic sort of Islam. Next slide, please. Another factor that was telling in favor of the Islamist parties is the relative popular support for religious institutions. Earlier on, we saw that many secular institutions, the press, the courts, bureaucracies, which are full of corrupt officials, are discredited in the eyes of Arabs. Religious institutions, on the other hand, have considerably more credit. In fact, across the three groups, 80% or more said that they had confidence in religious institutions. This reflects their belief that these institutions are more moral and less corrupt than their governments. And it gives a considerable punch to rhetoric around government morality and the greater probity of Islamic parties. So the fact that religious institutions are far more popular than secular institutions in these countries underlines the potential for political Islam. Now, it also underlines the potential for things to go off the rails, as the next slide underlines. The public in several countries takes a dim view of criticism of Islam and supports Sharia, although we don't have data from throughout the Arab world on this. But support for banning laws critical of Islam or other religions is voiced by 3/4 or more in Yemen, Egypt, Algeria, and Saudi Arabia. Likewise, large majorities favor cutting off hands for theft in Egypt and Jordan, or death for apostasy in both countries as well. What this suggests, in other words, is not that Sharia is about going to be steamrolled in by triumphant Muslim Brotherhood parliaments, but what it does suggest, as the current current trial of a broadcaster for putting on the air the movie Persepolis in Tunisia underlines, that if authoritarianism comes back in these countries, it will not come under a red star or a military boot. It will come under a green guise. Another potential flashpoint is interreligious tension and sectarian tension, because there's substantial tension between different sects and religions in several of the Arab countries. A dim view of Shias is taken by 3 out of 4 in Yemen, Algeria, and Saudi Arabia, and by a majority in Egypt. Similarly, attitudes towards Christians are hostile, 80% or more in Yemen, Algeria, and Saudi, 52% in Egypt. So as we've seen, and in fact as we saw in the events at Maspero in Egypt, sectarian and religious tensions in several important Sunni Arab countries are quite significant and also offer a possibility for political exploitation. Still, there are some things, on the other hand, that people do agree on. One is a rejection of extremist violence. Majorities in nearly every country in the survey thought that suicide bombing is never justified. 64% in group 1, 55% in group 2, 71% in group 3. Only in Lebanon, where suicide bombing has been employed as a weapon by Hezbollah, did a large number of people, 40%, say it was justified, although even there, the majority was opposed. So most Arabs think suicide attacks are never justified, except in places where it has been used frequently to oppose Israeli encroachments on national territory. Another point of agreement when it comes to international issues, most Arabs do not like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Pugh and Charney have asked fairly widely in the region about views on Ahmadinejad. But all the data are from Sunni majority states, except for Lebanon, where the Shia have a plurality. Across the region, about 3 in 10 have a favorable view of the Iranian president. His highest favorability is in Algeria at 41%, his lowest in Morocco at 20%. But Arabs, generally speaking, are unfavorable towards Ahmadinejad. Next slide. However, the bad news is that despite high hopes for America's standing in the region following the election of President Barack Obama, he does even worse than President Ahmadinejad on average. His favorability is about 1 in 4 in all three groups and slightly less than that of President Ahmadinejad. The highest favorabilities were in Bahrain and Kuwait at about 2 in 5, both pivotal U.S. partners in the region. But the majority of Arabs do not approve the job performance of U.S. leadership. Finally, the UN. Favorability towards the United Nations varies across the regions, but it's higher in countries that are the closest to its work on the Palestinian issue. Thus, favorable views on the UN are highest in Lebanon at 65% and in Egypt. These are countries where UNRWA's work, both in Palestine and with the refugees in those countries, is very highly appreciated. Next comes Algeria at 50%, then minorities at Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and only 20% in Morocco and Yemen. So views across the UN and the region are varied and seem to reflect distance or otherwise from Palestine. So to sum up, the most unstable countries had the smallest proportions of people who felt they were thriving. Economic discontent and political dissatisfaction lay behind these feelings. The most unstable countries were also marked by corruption and lack of faith in media, the law, and the vote. Most in the region want peaceful change in democracy and see no contradiction between democratic aspirations and Islam. And most also support free trade. Mobile phones have become ubiquitous throughout the Arab world, which helped Arab publics to organize, while the internet has tended to be the tool of elites. The primary news medium is TV, although print and internet are important in some countries. Al Jazeera is the number one news source, but national TVs also matter in several countries. Now, since the revolutions, after the revolutions, Egyptians and Tunisians were optimistic, but the economy and security both weigh on them. Many people in both those countries were not sure about the major political parties after the revolutions and in the run-up to the elections. The undecided voters turned to Islamist parties in large numbers, but late in the campaigns, giving significant victories to those parties. This reflects the fact that Arabs are drawn to the Turkish model and that they have more confidence in religious institutions than in their own political institutions. However, the flip side of this religious preponderance in politics is very real tensions between Sunni and Shia, as well as potential support for undemocratic measures justified in the name of Islam. Another aspect which may reflect sectarian tension is the unpopularity of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad throughout the region. A majority of Arabs, nonetheless, are hostile to the notion of extremist violence and suicide attacks. Unfortunately, the same is true for President Obama and America's leadership. While views of the UN, as I noted, tend to vary in relationship to the proximity and presence of the Palestinian issue. And that, dare I say, at a gallop, is a race through Arab public opinion on the Arab Spring. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me throw things open for questions. I would ask you several favors. One, please identify yourself and your organization, if any. Second, if you look around the room, could we make it a real question? There'll be ample opportunities on the steps outside CSIS for speeches after the meeting. And one question per intervention, please. And let me open things up for, please, the gentleman over there. Name and,
yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry. My name is Saeed Rekab from Al-Quds Daily newspaper. When you surveyed the Palestinians, did you include, did that include Gaza?
Absolutely.
Israeli Arabs?
Not Israeli Arabs, no. Gaza, yes. No, it was people in the territories.
The lady over there.
Darren McLeod, and I'm with Refugees International.
With what international?
Refugees International. I'm curious about your questions on leadership with both the U.S. and with Ahmadinejad.
No, it varied from time to time. In particular, in the middle part of the decade, the latter part of the decade, France and Sarkozy were well respected, particularly in certain countries. In the first year of his term, President Obama actually was polling fairly well in the Arab countries. It's largely after the disappointments of the last 2 years that his numbers have crashed.
Thanks. I'm Dave Pollack from the Washington Institute. Thank you very much.
I'm glad to meet you, David. I like your work.
Thanks. I want to go back to the very beginning of the presentation with the groups 1, 2, and 3 about economic and political factors, and make one quick point and then ask a real question. Well, the quick point is that I think groups 1 and 2 are really very, very different. And so it's in other words, in group 1, you had real revolutions or something very much like that, and mass popular uprisings. In group 2, you say instability, but it's really completely different in scale and effect, I think.
We agree. That's why they're in different groups.
So that leads me to the real question, which is, nevertheless, groups 1 and 2 are actually very similar in many of the underlying factors that you described in terms of attitudes on political and economic issues, and yet the effects are so different. Mm-hmm. So it would be very interesting to try and understand why it is that despite those broad similarities, the effects in those two groups are as different as they are. Yeah. And finally, I think I may have a kind of glimmer of an answer, then I wanted to ask if you agree with it. On economic issues, there's a pretty clear linear progression from most unstable, a little bit unstable, basically stable. But on political issues, you don't see that as much. In fact, in the charts that you presented, you see that group two is actually more negative about political issues than group one. So the question is this: does this mean that economic factors are actually decisive, even more so than political factors, in determining whether countries are going to be a little bit unstable or really, really unstable?
Great question, and it's one that I spent some time puzzling over as well. What I would say is twofold. First, what we see in this data set, which is limited, obviously, by the available data, three key differences between groups one and group two. First, group one sees a substantial decline in well-being in the group in the years immediately prior to the uprisings, as well as having the lowest level of well-being. That's important. But the notion of thriving isn't purely an economic one. If we were to unpack that, it actually reflects a couple of evaluations of current and future life chances, which reflect social and political as well as economic evaluations. Now, in this data, the clearest association is on the economic side, where we have a very clear distinction between worst assessments in the national economy in group one, better group two, best in group three. The political association that I find most interesting that splits them, though, is the one on voicelessness, where we find that the group where people feel most voiceless is also the group one countries. Now, I think if we had more data on the political side, I think we would also see that there are other indications in which those countries are set apart. But as I say, what we say is limited to the existing data. So I think clearly the economic factors are very powerful. I'd hesitate on this data to say that politics wasn't, though, because, as I said, my perception is it is overdetermined. These factors are playing together. But great, thank you for a great question.
I think, David, too, we need to be extremely careful here. The more you break the data out by country, the more different the countries really are in terms of the distribution on any given answer. The more you plunge into the area of soft statistics, and it is really hard to pull on what people mean by corruption, the more you find that this really stands out as both a political and a social and economic judgment. When you get down to terms like democracy, we had a classic problem throughout our Iraq intervention. We asked in the polls we published, do you prefer a strong leader, a religious leader, or democracy? And at least for a while, democracy won. If you ask the question very differently, can you choose all of the above nobody saw the discontinuities. And when it came down to the definition of democracy in another survey in Yemen, democracy was equated with Sharia by a very large percentage of the population, which did not see the difference. So that, education, there are things like the absence of housing. One of the things we tried to look at was, can you afford to get married? In a society like that, this is not a minor consideration. Mm-hmm. The answer often was no. And you were looking at, if you had a job, you still could not get sufficient status to have a life. This can discourage people, but it also has political implications.
Mm. Please,
the lady there.
Actually, I want to, Noah George, I'm Egyptian American, so mm-hmm. we'll have a quick question. One of, and I want to follow up on the definition of democracy, because that was my question, because you had it, one of the slides where it says that a lot of people, the majority, favored democracy. But was it defined for them, or was it assumed that it was the Western form of democracy? Or was there a specific definition of how do you define democracy?
Well, there are two questions, or two slides that bear on that. One, where we simply ask, do you prefer democracy or a democratic form of government or a strong man or undemocratic form of government? But the nature of democratic wasn't defined except by the contrast. On the other hand, the other one that I think is probative on this is the example where the Egyptians were polled on which system they preferred. And quite clearly, the Turkish case, where you have an Islamist government in what is clearly a pluralistic, or if you prefer, Western and constitutional form of government, was predominant. And the next most popular strain after that was Western European style government itself.
So the lady over there.
Thank you. Name is Courtney Vaughn, Gulf Lady, as in the Gulf of Guinea. My question is, there seemed to have been some sort of disconnect or communication block as it relates to what the reality has been on the ground in Egypt and Tunisia in particular. And I am wondering if you could address that. I understand the cases of, you know, other countries, in particular Libya. And considering that so much support has gone into a country like Egypt from the U.S. government, USAID, et cetera, what were they doing? And how comes, you know, it just seems as if what has happened has been unreal in terms of the just aggressive, you know, sort of upheaval, civil unrest, and, you know, the way we were looking at it just a day before or, you know, before this thing happens. And pretty much what was our resources, what was it being contributed to? Because I would imagine that in this arena with U.S. government, USAID, all the aid that was going into countries like Egypt, that it was going to support, you know, these sorts of institutions and governance, et cetera.
Well, part of it is we were looking at the wrong things. I remember that Tony and I were at a conference, in fact, in Abu Dhabi last November, where there were a panoply of Arab foreign ministers, and it seemed to be the high noon of the old regime. No one there had any idea that it was actually the sunset. Yet almost all the data I presented to you was available then. In fact, the very first version of this presentation came when I got a call from somebody at the UN last January who said, I have to explain what's going on in the Arab world to the Secretary General. Can you please figure it out for me? And I put together this presentation, but at that point, only Tunisia and Egypt had popped. And I thought, this is very odd. There are three other countries that look just like them, Bahrain, Yemen, and Syria. Well, they popped too. So part of it is, frankly, we were all looking at the wrong things. Not enough attention was paid to warning signs, like the contemptuous attitude the Egyptian regime displayed towards its own people in blatantly rigging the November 2010 elections. And when it comes to all the things the U.S. was doing, the truth is we did a great deal of good. In Egypt, for example, child health programs, anti-pollution programs, various other things that were quite important and helped quite a lot of people. But we did some focus groups there a few years ago for the Council on Foreign Relations, which showed that they were virtually unknown. Yet everyone knew the Japanese had paid for the Opera House. And that reflected in part the failures of our public diplomacy as well.
I think, too, you have to be very careful because individual projects do good, but when you talk about large amounts of civil aid relative to the population of Egypt and the distribution of where the money went, it was very, very small money dealing with an extremely large country. And you also had extremely sharp restrictions on what American diplomats could actually influence the Egyptians to do. Often there were programs, I can remember when I was there, where we started the program, but the output was warehoused because it was politically undesirable and never used. When it came down to the military side, basically speaking, understand that people outside the military, and usually military officers, do not see the impact of that aid, all it will have a major impact on elites. And when you come down to other countries, we really have Egypt, and then we have Egypt, and then we have Egypt, because the money simply wasn't high enough to have that much impact in other countries in the Arab world.
Me? Yeah. Harvey Sloan from the Eurasian Medical Education Program. What do you think our policy as a country should be going forward, given the unpopularity generally of our leadership and the country? And do we continue with Egypt as we have in the past, or we really start to try to get into Yemen, Libya, and some of these other countries in civil aid?
Well, we may have a new chance to get into the game. There is, after all, a new regime coming in, and that's an opportunity for new beginnings. Part of it is going to mean keeping our nerve and dealing with some bits of rhetoric we won't like. Ironically, at this point, of course, we're having less difficulty with the Muslim Brotherhood than we are with the Falul, or remnant, Minister of International Cooperation, who, as you saw from today's paper, has launched a process which has resulted in NDI and IRI people being stopped at the airport and forbidden from leaving because they are the subjects of criminal investigation. It is the old regime, ironically, rather than the new one, which is causing us greater trouble at this point. But I think, obviously, in terms of supporting Egypt against economic collapse along the lines of the increased trade and aid, as well as the support for an IMF loan, accepting the idea that Egypt has a right to determine its own destiny and supporting the workings of democratic political institutions, helping to ensure that those institutions are strengthened and that pluralistic elections continue. And finally, that remnants of the old regime do not actually succeed in the kind of anti-American games that they are playing.
I think, too, I would add to that, looking at both the material data and the surveys, one of the great problems is the assumption you can have a general Middle East policy focused on strategic communications and centered in Washington. This is perhaps the worst conceivable time to cut back on your country teams, to not try to adapt to the individual needs of individual countries, to try to choose a solution that fits all of the countries at once, and then to promote them, and particularly to have a constant rotation and instability in programs. Unfortunately, that pretty well describes the FY13 budget submission, so it's going to be a rather painful experience. We just are not prepared to react by strengthening our efforts in individual countries, using aid more effectively, looking beyond our own boundaries for activity. We're simply going to vote with our money. Let me begin with the two ladies in back at
I think that's surely one of the factors in their popularity. You know, the services weren't large, but they indicated that their hearts were in the right place compared to a government which is seen as neither delivering nor having its heart in the right place. But I think it's one of a number of factors that was helpful to them. You know, I read during the campaign a blog by someone who was not in the Brotherhood, an Egyptian doctor, describing a Brotherhood campaign event. And as someone who works on political campaigns, I must say I was very impressed. At the entrance to this large gathering, which was held outdoor where there was walls around the enclosure, everyone who walked in was given a post-it and told to write on it their hopes for the future of Egypt and to stick that on the wall. Brilliant. I wish I'd come up with that one myself. I'm sorry to say we didn't include Oman for the simple reason that we couldn't find any polling data at all from Oman. And on the Sunni-Shia issue, yes, we do normally ask about that. It's only relevant in a few countries or contexts, though, particularly in Lebanon, obviously.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to take it.
Please.
David Throop from Johns Hopkins Seitz and the Africa program at CSIS. You mentioned that there was quite a late swing from September onwards towards the Muslim Brotherhood parties, and presumably that was the swing from the uncommitted and maybe pro-secular parties. Why were the pro-secular parties, why did they lose it in a sense? During the last 2 or 3 months of last year, were they Muslim Brotherhood just more effective at campaigning, or were people reluctant to come out, say in June and September, saying we're going to vote for the Muslim Brotherhood, and they say we're uncommitted, whereas probably they were always intending to vote for the Brotherhood all along?
I think this is the story the data tell. Most people didn't know much about politics and weren't very involved in politics under the old regime. When we did focus groups in July, we heard as much from them. And that produced the very large proportions of can't identify or can't express an opinion about these parties that we see in the polling for March, April, and June. So no, I don't think they were hidden Brotherhood supporters. I think they were genuine don't knows. And I think there are several factors. Not only does the Brotherhood have the best national campaign and message, not only is it connected to religious institutions which are in better credit than secular institutions, but the secular parties waged a disastrous campaign. They didn't have national presence. They had little media except for the Free Egyptians, with Sawira, since their owner their key figure was the owner of a national television network. And they spent much of the 2 weeks prior to the first round of the election running around in Tahrir Square and giving interviews to foreign media instead of doing Get Out the Vote.
I think, too, that one thing, just because you're secular doesn't mean you have a message. And if you are focusing essentially on interesting trivia and you are not basically responding to people's material concerns as a secular party, you have a real problem. Yeah. And very often the message was, put it mildly, confused, focused much more on political issues, which if you were on the street, didn't promise you very much.
This, incidentally, is why the attack on NDI and IRI and Freedom House matters so much, because if these organizations have a chance to work with the Egyptian political parties, there is a chance that the second or third election will be different if they are driven out or restricted so heavily that they can't do their work effectively. That will also really damage severely the chances of other parties to develop.
Now, I'd also remember, there's one other poll that tells you a little about what happens over time, and that is, if you looked at Iraq, the amazing degree to which people kept voting against the incumbent. In other words, if you don't perform, regardless of what your party, sect, or the rest is, people have a strange habit of voting against you to the extent they can. Is there a last question from someone who hasn't asked one? Well, there seem to be a lot more last questions we have time for. Let the gentleman there.
My name is John Zanikos. I'm with the Center for International Private Enterprise. And along this vein, I was wondering if you found an increased rate of participation in terms of not just voting, but in forming civil society organizations, participating in those organizations in Egypt and Tunisia? Thanks.
We don't have rate of increase because we don't have historical data, unfortunately. What we did find, if some recent unpublished work we've done, is that civil society organizations are pretty weak in Egypt, weak than other countries we've worked in going through democratic transitions like Indonesia, for example. The old regime wasn't very favorable to them.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't think we can resolve all of these issues in the course of this meeting, but if I may, I would like you to thank Craig in the usual manner.
Thank you all.
Let me also note, if you did not sign up or you didn't get the pad, Craig did circulate that, so if you want copies of the presentation, you can get it. And the material I gave will be on the CSIS website.